This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky. In advance of tomorrow morning's Germany versus Argentina match, I've asked Thomas Gagan to join us on The People's Game. Thomas Gagan is a lawyer in Chicago and is the author of many books, including Which Side Are You On?, a classic about the American labor movement. And his new book is Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? How the European Model Can Help You Get a Life. And so before I ask Thomas Gagan briefly to tell us a little bit about the new book, I want to say why I asked him on, because I saw a great article, which we'll also touch on, in Harper's Magazine in March called Consider the Germans. And he's talking about how the German economy is really something to be looked at closely, even by Americans. And, okay, Europe, socialist economy, different model than America, people say. Well, let's look at how it is structured in Germany. How are they able to have such incredible industrial productivity? They still have all their manufacturing jobs. They have a stable, high-wage, middle-class society. Seems prosperous, seems safe. What is going on there? And the article looks in detail at German society. And so the German national team has moved into the semifinals. Everybody in the world will be thinking on some level or another, or so many people in the world, as many as ever do, will be thinking about Germany tomorrow. So I've asked Thomas Gagan to join us and to talk about Europe, European social democracy, and the Germans in specific. First off, your book is called Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? How the European Model Can Help You Get a Life. Tell us just a little bit about the book.
The book is a defense of the European, and especially the German model, which is one where you can have a country of 82 million people being, through most of the last decade, the leading exporter of goods in the world, beating China significantly, might even beat China again this year. And yet they get 6 weeks off, they have 13 paid holidays, they seem to do it with one hand tied behind their backs, while we work till we drop. So I think this model, which involves a lot of worker control, is one that Americans, or especially Americans, ought to take very seriously.
So let's talk a little bit about this.
Alan, I've got to tell you, I'm a White Sox fan, and adopting the European model does not mean that you give up your loyalty to baseball.
Well, this is an issue right now, as the global game finally seems to be coming in a significant way to the United States. I'm sure you've seen the headlines with how many people are watching it this time compared to ever before.
And the uproar over the victory over England and the goal that was involved.
It's been followed more passionately and more closely, and I believe even with the United States out of the tournament, that is the case. And Germany is a country in global football that is, of course, one of the great powers, but there was an expectation that the team wouldn't be that strong this year. But as with pretty much all German social institutions, including the soccer institutions, it just continues to produce quality product. And the team on the field this year has already exceeded expectations going into the tournament. So let's talk a little bit about how Germany is structured and why there is such sort of a consistent, stable prosperity in Germany.
One thing, Alan, about the soccer, though, people were also really, I think around the world, soccer fans were kind of knocked out in 2006 by kind of the cool way the Germans pulled off the 2006 World Cup. It was done a very relaxed way. It was hip. It was a lot of fun. I think the Germans don't get a credit enough for the fact that they do have a lot of fun.
Oh, my word. I mean, one of the paradoxes when people consider Germany is, you know, we're going to go to Europe, we're going to go to France, we're going to go to Italy, we're going to go to Barcelona, all these fun places. Germany, people don't think of it, and then they go, oh, but we're going to go to Berlin. And, of course, Berlin is one of the most fun cities in the world. And, of course, that was where the final were played. But, you know, this spirit actually animates large parts of the country.
But even Frankfurt is cool. You know, it's 24%, 25% of it is international. They're not Germans who live there. And okay, they're bankers. But these people take 6 weeks off. I mean, they go to these wild places like Malaya and stuff like that, which, you know, out here in America, you know, if we get off 3 days to take a trip to Toronto, it's considered a big deal.
So how do they pull this off? I mean, after all, if you look at what in generally the rest of the world is referred to this era of neoliberal capitalism, the post-Cold War era, building upon the Reagan and Thatcher years, workers have less power. Corporations have more control to leave the country. All, in fact, the manufacturing base of the United States, so much of it has just left the country. Let's start off there. Why is it that Germany, I mean, look at the number of cars the Germans produce. And by the way, Volkswagen is having an incredible decade in terms of its global popularity. In fact, sure. I think it exceeds Toyota as the biggest car seller in the world right now.
A German kid I met just on a train once told me that there are really two Germanys. And I said, East and West? No. North and South? No. Catholic and Protestant? No. What are the two Germanys? He said Mercedes and BMW. Those are basically the two Germanys, Stuttgart and Munich. And I said, well, what about Volkswagen? He said, well, all right, Volkswagen too. So what are the three reasons the Germans are this leading exporter in the world and running up and big creditor country while we're a big debtor country? And while they take 6 weeks off and we don't get any vacation at all this summer.
Sure.
How do they do it? There are three reasons. First, they've got a labor movement. I mean, they do have a socialist party, and they have the world's oldest, biggest, still biggest, strongest labor movement in the world. No other country can match it. It has the strongest labor movement. So I'm attracted as a labor lawyer to a country that has a labor movement. You know, this is what I want. There are two other reasons that I think really explain the difference. One is the party of the right is pro-labor, kind of bizarre. The Christian Democratic Union, I'm not talking about the Free Democrats who are neoliberals, sort of like the Republicans and the Democrats here, but the Christian Democratic Union is actually kind of pro-worker. I mean, they have union representation in the party, and it comes out of the fact that they were started by Catholics who were influenced by the papal encyclicals on labor. The third reason is that we, the U.S., set it up that way. You know, after World War II, we came over, we had General Lucius Clay and Dwight Eisenhower, and they had all these German businessmen. They couldn't throw them all in jail. So the occupation put workers on the boards. And while co-determination had been around in the Weimar Republic and to some extent, our military put a stamp on it. We kind of helped set up the German model in the late 1940s. Those are the three big reasons why they're different.
And they did that in part because why was that done by the United States? Was it because we simply had people coming out of the Roosevelt administration or the progressive branch of the Truman administration, or was it because of fear of business?
It was the New Deal. We were the left-wing social democracy of that era, and we came up, we set up something that was a little like, it drew on German traditions. I mean, they had a labor movement that an army of occupation could build on. But it was their own. It was not just the New Dealers, but the British Labor Party. It was the socialists, quote-unquote, in America and in Britain were structuring the country. And this is their legacy. It's like, you know, when you look over at Germany, you see a little bit, I don't want to exaggerate this, but a little bit of our own American history, our own New Deal being reflected back to us. You know, we've scrapped it, but they've still got it.
Right. Before we get on to some of the details, and I'm talking with Thomas Gagan, who, by the way, besides being an author and a lawyer in Chicago, also ran recently a campaign for the U.S. House of Representatives. And are you considering possibly doing that again, sir?
If I had known it was as cold as it was during that special election, I would never have done it, Alan. Never.
It was for Rahm Emanuel's seat, right? So it was a dead winter. Yeah.
If I ever do it again, it's going to be in warmer weather.
Yeah, well, sure, you can get that if you have a primary. We just had our primaries here, so that would have worked out a little better for you. Cold in Chicago in the winter. So let's, before we get to the details about Germany and how it is that they maintained this through some of the structures that exist there, and some are quite unique, or at least something I hadn't been aware of in detail before, let's talk about the sort of wage equity that exists in Germany. I mean, how firmly established and not just constantly being squeezed and lessened is the German middle class. How solid a part of German society is that right
now?
The German middle class
does very well. There are people who are cut out of the action, and you and there's a party of the left called the Links, which is upset about it, especially people in the old East Germany, never been integrated into the system very well. And there are people who don't have adequate education to be part of it. But what we would call our middle class over there, they do very well. You know, they have these great job protections. They have, depending on where they work, they have a kind of right to agency, of worker control, that's not too strong a word, that is beyond our imagination. And they have these great pensions. You know, so they're going to, their retirement age is 65. They're going to raise it to 67, but they're still their effective retirement age is probably about 2 years behind that. I mean, they get out earlier than the normal retirement age for various reasons. They have mm-hmm. benefits and transitions. The people who have retired in Germany, middle class, probably are making more as a result of their pensions and all their other benefits than they made when they were working, and they did fine when they were working. They have a very high savings rate. They have enormously, well, they have all sorts of free public goods. They have all sorts of things that we never have to, that they never have to pay out, you know, whether they don't have to save for their pensions. They've got a great state pension system. They don't pay anything for university of education. It's basically free. I mean, there are nominal charges in some of the Länder and some aren't. They have nursing home care. They have a whole, and they have a transit system that works. They don't even, although they love their cars and they're crazy about them, you know, you can live in Berlin, you can live in Frankfurt without ever having a car. It's very easy. And the public goods are just delivered in such an efficient way that even though they have higher taxes than we do, they also have higher savings rates. So, you know, go figure. The U.S. has lower taxes, slightly lower taxes, but we're all in debt. They have higher taxes, and they have huge savings in their bank accounts. It's really due to the fact that they do get these public goods for free, and they're delivered in a very efficient way.
And health care is?
Oh, health care is. They have a great health care system.
And it's entirely?
They have caps on it. You know, so they have probably, they spend the most of health care of any European social democracy, which is about 10 or 11% of their GDP. And we're at about 17 or 18%, and that's going to explode when the universal health care comes in because we're going to be taking care of far more people. They have a good life.
These structures, again, and maybe we can go over them quickly, what exactly are works councils and co-determined boards?
Well, there are three really important things
right.
that the Germans have. And when we talk about the German working class, middle class, I mean, we're talking about people over here who would be considered working class or not middle class. I mean, the AG Metall union and all these skilled workers who are doing blue-collar jobs, I mean, they're quite well off. What is it that they've got at AG Metall, or what would they have in the Harper's article I talked about, imagine a bookstore like Barnes & Noble?
Right.
First, you've got a works council where you, as the employee, get to directly elect or run for yourself for this council, which has enormous power over how the Barnes & Noble bookstore at Webster and Clybourne is run, or the plant at, in Erfurt, Germany. Management has to come to agreements with you. You have veto powers over when the plant opens, when it closes, who gets laid off, who is fired, how early you can get home to go to the theater. There are all sorts of ways in which the managers have to co-manage with the people that the workers elect to the works councils. So that's the basic level. And that's actually expanded in the last 10 years. It hasn't contracted. Then there's co-determination. Which
this is incredible. People should listen to this.
Yeah, it's a little hard for us to imagine. And it applies only to large enterprises of 2,000 or more. But there are a lot of large enterprises over there, and the smaller businesses are very, very union-friendly. In fact, they're more union-friendly than the big businesses. But in the big businesses, you know, the workers elect half the directors on the board. Now, these boards aren't quite like our board of directors, but they are the ultimate power in the corporation, and they don't manage as hands-on way as the board of directors somewhat does in the U.S., but they have the power to determine who is the president and so forth. Well, half the votes on that board are employee votes and half are stockholders. So what happens when they come to a tie? Well, the chairman of the board is picked by the stockholders and he gets a second vote to break a tie. So in a deadlock, an absolute deadlock, capital wins over labor. But there are all sorts of issues that come up, you know, like who's going to be the head of Daimler-Benz, where when the stockholders are split, the workers decide who's going to be the boss. It's an enormous amount of power, and it's even more important that, you know, things like, well, we're all upset now about Citizens United and corporations making big contributions to the Republicans and so forth.
Right.
Well, it's a little hard to do that if you've got half the board consisting of workers. You know, I mean, they're there in the room when these, we're going to give, $50,000 to Sarah Palin. I don't think so. You know, I mean, you just, the fact that there's this visibility, even though they ultimately have the tie-breaking vote on the management side, the fact that this is all in a fishbowl, the fact that your behavior changes as a manager if you've got half the directors sitting on the other side of the table being your employees.
Right, so closing down factories, moving, you know, closing up shop, moving to China for production, pretty much has been blocked.
They do that.
Right.
They do close down factories, and they do send capital over, and technically, you know, in the end, the workers can't stop it, but they can always make it difficult, and it's done... with a lot more horse trading back and forth. Okay, we'll let this plant go down, but you've got to put more money over in plant B over here.
Right, but the clear effect
keeps the industry there.
Right, in macro economic effect, it hasn't been impacted. Then, I mean, you look at the manufacturing sector in Germany, and it's as powerful as ever. You look at the manufacturing sector here. And it's
automation and everything else, there are fewer people who are employed in manufacturing. But the big unions are, you know, AG Metall was, its membership is down 10% from 1973. You know, if you look at the, AG Metall is the union that is like United Auto Workers and Steel Workers combined. If you look at United Auto Workers and Steel Workers combined, I laugh and I should be crying.
Right.
You know, the drops are more like 60-70%, and those are illusory because a lot of those steel workers and United Auto Workers are people who are kitchen staff at, state prisons that they've organized. You know, it's not, they aren't really manufacturing employees. So it's just a different world over there.
And the third institution you mentioned are called wage, or third element is called wage-setting institutions.
Yeah, it's collective bargaining.
Right.
You know, I mean, they set wages the way we used to do that in the 1950s and 1960s at regional levels. And that has been, as I said in the article, that's been cut back. And there is more inequality in Germany than there was. But it's far, far, far less than the huge increase in inequality in the U.S. And most of the inequality in Germany has come from the fact that they have had to incorporate East Germans in, and there's a lot of unemployment and so on and so forth in East Germany, and you have to factor that in when you're looking at income effects. And the German model isn't very good at turning out lots of low McJobs.
Right.
But the flip side is, you know, what we used to call West Germany, there's probably been little or no increase in inequality in, say, the last 20 years. The overall increase in inequality comes overwhelmingly from the East German part of the economy.
And I'm guessing
that even that is, you know, pretty moderate. Even aggregate, it's pretty moderate compared to the U.S. So.
And I'm guessing, given this week's big news, and really big news, with the consumer confidence report in the United States, I'm guessing they didn't have a 10% drop in consumer confidence at any time recently in Germany.
Well, the Germans are always in despair, you know. I mean, it's a very pessimistic country. But at the moment, they seem to be, they went got into a funk over the fact that they always have to bail out everybody at the fringes of the European Union, which went in a hawk to Goldman Sachs and especially the Greek thing.
Right.
But I think the mood is right now over there is really quite good, and not just because they beat England.
Well, we'll get back to soccer in one moment, but I do want to say that in the Harper's article, which I read, you know, you mentioned these three things at the top of the article, and you say, everyone in class groans, whatever do those things mean? And then you say, if you were, you know, a lecturer in a class, you'd start out with these three elements you want to describe. Well, actually, it's a very engaging article, and that kind of, you know, social organizational detail you write about in a tremendously engaging manner, and I imagine it's all going to be covered in your book, which is coming out later in the summer.
Yep.
Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? How the European Model Can Help You Get a Life by Thomas Gagan. Look for that coming out in August. Now, to soccer, I spoke with you ever so briefly the other day, and one of the things that is huge in global soccer right now at the club level are all this sort of like these teams get bought up by, you know, capitalists, by people who have tons of money from the Gulf, and sometimes a big influx of money pours in, and then, of course, their investments have gone bad, and all of a sudden the team is absolutely bankrupt. This has happened not with money from the Gulf, but actually money from the United States with people who Blues investments really cut into the base of wealth for the clubs at two of the most popular clubs in the world, Manchester United and Liverpool. In both cases, because of this, the fans started movements, very powerful movements, for the fans to retake control of the clubs. Well, guess what? Germany, as we're talking about, progressive structures within Germany. A few years ago, in the German Bundesliga, they tried to reverse a rule which insists that these football teams are still owned by the local clubs. They're old, ancient, traditional clubs that started as local clubs, meaning, you know, you went down there, you played, and the best players formed a team, and they started playing the teams from the other towns. We're talking, you know, earlier in the 20th century. And this is how it still functions in Germany to this day. Every team in the top German league, the Bundesliga, must be owned 50% plus one vote by the actual members of the club. And in 2008, the sort of forces of capital, as it were, tried to challenge this. They were not successful. And in light of what's been going on with these great, fantastically popular clubs around the world like Manchester United and Liverpool, people are looking to Germany again for a progressive humanist structure for the ownership of soccer teams. So again, Germany, and this is reflected, I think, also in the players that we see. One of the things this has meant is that besides the top team in Germany, Bayern Munich, the German teams haven't really been competing with these clubs that get this huge infusion of foreign capital, and they buy the greatest players in the world. In fact, Chelsea, one of the teams in England owned by Roman Abramovich, a Russian oligarch with billions of dollars, right, from energy, bought Michael Ballack, the top German player. This wasn't really happening with German teams, and so the German side that comes into the World Cup isn't considered to be filled with superstars. People say that, oh, they're not going to be that strong this year, but in fact, so many of them are at the Bundesliga level, people don't see them because these clubs don't have the big-moneyed superstars, and it turns out they're fantastic. So on both levels, not only is it still local ownership of clubs without the risk of the team going under because of bad investments by the owners, but also at the level of developing great national soccer talent, people really should look to the Bundesliga. In fact, all sports clubs should look to the Bundesliga as a model for ownership of clubs. So again, Germany has a fantastic, again, a sort of social democratic humanist institutions, even when it comes to football.
Well, they like to say over there, even the politicians, you know, and it's a capitalist society. I don't want to say otherwise, but it's a different kind of capitalism, and it's quite acceptable, not just for the SPD, the socialist politicians, but even on the right, the Catholic, the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union politicians, to say, you know, we don't buy into normal capitalism. We don't like U.S.-type capitalism. We don't like... They really don't like British capitalism, and the British used to taunt them in the Blair era, and now the Germans are having the last laugh, and plus they beat them in
football. Life. They beat them badly.
Yes.
Well,
the British are going through a bad time.
yes, they have the great they have the blood on their hands from the Gulf, as it were.
Well, we should celebrate being independent of them fourth, because if we were still part of Britain, we'd be in a terrible economic mess right now. They've got terrible deficits, and they're raising taxes, and it's very grim over there.
And now Merkel is in some kind of crisis, though, right, because of the handling of Greece?
Yeah, kind of. She's kind of in a crisis more because she's in a coalition with the Free Democratic Party, the FDP, which is neoliberal, and they're just like the Democrats in the U.S. Actually, to some extent, or somebody's other, to the left of the Democrats, but they're way to the right of the Germans on most economic issues, and they're very, very unpopular. And she's had to govern with them, and that's detracted from her popularity. But there's also the Greek problem. I mean, they have to think about the Germans. First, they bring in all these countries, which are really kind of poor, like Portugal and Greece, and they make them part of the EU. They didn't have to do this. They did it. And the EU bankrolled them. They built them up. And so Germany put out a lot of money to help build these countries up, Ireland. Then a lot of these same countries then turned around, like Ireland, and said, oh, we're the low-tax haven, and tried to bid corporations away from Germany after they had paid all this money to set them up. So the Germans didn't like that. Then These countries, you know, aren't able to pay their way. So they went out and they got big loans from Goldman Sachs, which only lent the money to them because they figured, well, if the Irish default or the Greeks default or the Portuguese default, the Germans will pay us.
Right.
So, and sure enough, that's what happened. So now the Germans are paying them after Merkel hesitated. And now these same countries are going around and saying, you know, the Irish, Portuguese, and Greece, and telling Germany, well, you've got to stimulate your economy more and run a big deficit because we need to keep going here. And, you know, it's like the third time they've gone to the well with the Germans. And some of the Germans have said, not completely unreasonably, hey, you know, what are we getting out of this? So,
and right, and if people are who are listening to the show have been like myself, doing little but watching soccer games these past few weeks, Greece again has had the Greek team didn't get to the second round, and the Greeks have taken to the streets again, not because the team didn't get to the second round of the World Cup, but because the protests are quite something in Greece. There is
I'm sympathetic with the Greeks and the Portuguese and the Irish, especially the working people. I mean, it's a terrible situation to be in. But before you bash the Germans for not doing more to help them, I mean, they've done a lot.
Well, I suppose at the end of this interview, the most salient point, and no, not relating to the soccer, though nothing, of course, on this show is more important than the soccer, but the United States economy is anything but like the contemporary German economy, and it is in deep trouble. And individual households are in a lot of trouble. And people like yourself and myself and the work we do at Pacifica Radio, we try to show people what exists in the rest of the world that could be a positive model. You ask in the Harper's article, and I'm sure you do in your book as well, as the title suggests, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? How the European Model Can Help You Get a Life. What would it take for a significant block of the United States to recognize that contemporary high-tech, high trade capitalism can be organized in a much more human-friendly way, as it is in Germany?
You know, I struggle with that. It would be great if the Democratic Party came forward and said, especially because people are worried about the debt that we're in, they should come forward and say, which they've never said, we are going to make it a goal of this political party and this administration to eliminate the trade deficit. You know, Germany, high-wage union country, is running a big trade surplus.
Mm-hmm.
We can do it, too. If they can do it, we can do it. And the fact is, we can do it. You know, everything that, and I think the left has bought into this idea too often that, we can't do anything about the trade deficits, the global economy, and blah, 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 blah. Well, the Germans aren't in debt. You know, if you hold down your financial sector, if you try to get out of the clutches of foreign creditors, which the way the Germans have successfully done, I mean, you can build up a manufacturing sector. They're serving markets right now that should be ours. Why is that? It's not because of the Chinese. It's not because of their low wages. It's not because they're union-free. I mean, it's just the opposite. Why aren't we doing that? And that's what I'm trying to get across in this book while also entertaining people at the same time.
Well, Thomas Gagan, it's great to have you here on The People's Game. Thomas Gagan is a lawyer in Chicago, and his new book coming out in August is Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? How the European Model Can Help You Get a Life. And the article, Consider the Germans, you can find online by Googling Thomas Gagan, which is G-E-O-G-H-E-G-A-N, and you can find that online from Harper's Magazine. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.